Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of FIEC, and we're doing our usual news roundup today. I've got Adrian Reynolds with me, Head of National Ministries. Good morning.
Hello.
And our National Director, John Stevens. Good morning to you, John.
And we've all had a haircut.
You and John have. Mine is getting increasingly long, what's left of it, if you're watching the video. There we are. So let's begin this week. We'll talk about Ukraine in a few minutes, but I wanted to talk, to start with this week, about conversion therapy and all the things that seem to be underlying the multi-layers of that we've encountered this last couple of weeks. And first of all, I just want to talk about how the announcement was made about a conversion therapy ban making its way into the Queen's speech.
Made and unmade.
Well, exactly. Unmade, so yes. It reminded me of, I think there's a Thickovit sketch where he says, I can't U-turn on the U-turn. That's an O-turn. But actually, that's exactly what we seem to have, wasn't it? Yeah. So this was very strange. So we got a leaked document that said there was going to be no conversion therapy ban. And then there was an outcry, and then there was going to be a conversion therapy ban, but it would exclude issues to do with people struggling with transgender issues. Just the way that announcement was made.
And then a mass cancellation.
Well, precisely. But is that, I think my first question is that a way to do policy, first of all? Does that make for good policy for anyone, for Christians and for people from the LGBT community? Does that help anyone?
I think, first of all, we have to recognise that actually there are powerful lobby groups at work here, that the whole issue of conversion therapy has become symbolic and totemic of the way that society treats those from the LGBTQ community. Mm. So at one level, the government leapt on wanting to introduce a conversion therapy ban in order to be able to demonstrate their LGBTQ credentials. I think when they then embarked on a consultation process, they discovered how much more difficult it was to introduce in practice, that in reality, forms of conversion therapy that most of us would think are wrong are already unlawful.
Yep.
And actually, there's a disagreement amongst LGBTQ activists as to exactly what kind of ban they want, particularly whether simply ordinary counselling, pastoral care for people struggling with same-sex attraction should be banned. So at the extreme end, someone like Jane Ozanne would believe that even teaching the biblical truth that sort of sexual relationships are to be exclusively heterosexual is harmful and should be prevented. So government has been attempting to wrestle with this. It's very difficult to define where the boundary line is between what is abusive and harmful and what is not. Then the whole issue of transgender has come into that, because it was pointed out that a conversion therapy ban could then make it very difficult to provide counselling and help to people who are struggling with issues of gender identity. So I think the consultation process and the response from religious organisations, not just Christians, but also others as well, made the government aware that this was actually a much more difficult and more complicated piece of legislation. And as was pointed out by the Evangelical Alliance, the fundamental problem is they've never been clear as to how they define conversion therapy.
Well, I was going to say that. So what is the kind of working definition? Is there even one?
Well, I think that's the work in progress. They're trying to work out where is the definition to be found and where are the boundaries to be found. And it's clear that the government group working on this recognised all of these challenges and had reached the conclusion that it wasn't worth bringing legislation forwards. So a memo was being prepared to announce why government was not going to introduce legislation, actually because of the consultation. In fact, it showed here that government had listened, and actually the memo has now been leaked, and it contains statements that say that there's no evidential base for banning conversion therapy, and therefore the consultation process has not supported this legislation. And it seems that what happened is somebody on the inside leaked this memo to the press, to ITN, leaked the decision of the Prime Minister not to press ahead. And that, of course, led to the story being broken that conversion therapy bans were not going to be pursued. That led to a massive backlash from the LGBTQ community, claims of betrayal, various government ministers and MPs who are supportive threatening to resign, which then led to the U-turn of saying, we are going to introduce conversion therapy, but we're not going to introduce it for the transgender community because we don't know how to overcome that challenge in the legislation. That itself has had a backlash.
Yeah, that's bombed, hasn't it? It's like gone down like a lead balloon with the community.
Well, again, transgender isn't, there's not a common view on that. So for some people, they think the decision not to include transgender is good. For others, so for example, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, kind of Rowan Williams, has said that there ought to be a ban on conversion therapy because actually you're only becoming whole as a human being if you transition, if you experience transgender sort of feelings, which of course doesn't fit with the biblical understanding at all. So there's total confusion, both in government and indeed within some of the lobby groups, the trans groups. And I think what's really clear about this is government policymaking has been made not on the basis of what is right, good, and works. So the memo demonstrates that the consultation didn't justify the introduction of a ban. It wasn't necessary. But the government is more interested in being seen to take a particular position. And it's shown the degree to which they are influenced by a particular lobby group, even though the legislation is phenomenally difficult to properly draft. And there doesn't seem to be a real need for it on the basis of the consultation that's taken place. And I think that just shows something of the world in which we're operating, that government are not making sensible decisions as to what is in the best interest of the nation and individuals, balancing the rights of different groups within society. But they're responding to the assertions of certain lobby groups who they feel they have to appease. And that's why it's in total chaos.
On the transgender question, there's been some good news this week, hasn't there, with the Commission on Equality making a ruling. Tell us a bit more about that, John. And just, there are some implications there, aren't there, for church leaders, actually, in terms of how you're organising your events now and the kinds of things you're doing now.
Yeah, the big question here, the big challenge in society is how to accommodate people who are transgender, particularly those who are men who are identifying as women. Some are identifying as women and then undergoing gender reassignment surgery. Others simply claiming the right to self-identify as women whilst remaining biologically male. Mm. The question that's been raised by that is to what extent do organisations, institutions need to allow people who self-identify as women to be able to, in a sense, participate in women-only activities.
So I mean, the classic things are women-only, changing spaces and exercise groups, things like that. But of course, many churches run women's-only groups,
absolutely,
don't they?
Yeah. And so that up until now, the general kind of mood seems to have been that there's an obligation to recognise people on the basis of the gender that they claim for themselves. And the trans activists will claim that if you don't do that, you're denying that they're really a woman. And here's a person claiming that they are a woman and they're believing they're a woman. Well, what the Equality and Human Rights Commission has done is it's provided some guidance on what the law really requires. And they've made clear that the law doesn't give an absolute right for somebody who is transgender to insist in taking part in single-sex services and activities, that actually the law draws a balance. There is a legal right to exclude people who are transgender from single-sex spaces, provided that that is proportionate and provided that a provision is made for those who are transgender. So that has implications, for example, for the use of, as you say, toilet facilities. And it may well be that community centres, churches, elsewhere have a right to have exclusively biological female toilets and biologically male toilets, as long as they make provision for those who are transgender by, for example, providing a gender-neutral toilet that people can use. In fact, I've noticed that new church buildings often have just cubicles rather than male and female toilets, and they're available to people of both genders anyway, which I think is a very sensible kind of solution. But the law does at least allow you to still maintain that distinction. Mm. It means, for example, in kind of community centres and swimming pools, you can have women-only swimming sessions if the women who go wouldn't go or would feel that they lacked dignity or they were unsafe if it was to be open to transgender people. I think from a church perspective, one of the interesting things the Equalities and Human Rights Commission identifies as a reason why it might be legitimate to exclude trans people from a single-sex activity is if people have a religious belief that means that they wouldn't attend it because of their beliefs about transgenderism. So you can see that in a church context, say, for example, you have a women's Bible study, the women who attend that Bible study might not be comfortable attending if there's somebody who's identifying as transgender wanting to come to that group. And the advice from the Human Rights Commission would say that it would be therefore proportionate to be able to define the group as being only for those who are biologically female and not to include those who simply identify.
It seems like quite a significant ruling, actually, in terms of this whole debate and everything that's been going on. Has there been much backlash?
There's been backlash against it from the transgender community. Yep. And I think what's interesting is it doesn't in any way change the law. No. This is simply an attempt to explain what the law is. And I think within the wider culture, there have been presumptions as to what the equality law requires that aren't actually a faithful representation of the law. So Stonewall and others have been criticised for advocating this idea that those who identify as transgender have a right in every context to be treated as belonging to the sex of the gender that they've claimed for themselves. What this guidance does, it makes very clear that that was never the law. And that there is a delicate balancing process to be adopted. And of course, another area where this is so sort of relevant is in the issue of women's sport. Mm. And actually we have an ongoing debate as to whether or not those who identify as transgender can participate in women's sport. It seems indisputable that if you are born biologically male, and particularly if you pass through puberty, you have advantages that are lasting and enduring, even if you transition, even if you have surgery. Mm. And of course, the danger with that is of kind of undermining women's sport altogether. So the Prime Minister this week made clear that he thought that biology was relevant to women engaging in a kind of sport. Certainly this guidance would allow the exclusion of transgender women from women's sport. Interestingly, the sports bodies aren't necessarily taking that approach. So that's not what they're obliged to do. Mm. So Sport UK has adopted an approach more orientated around the levels of testosterone in a person's body. Mm. So this is just an ongoing debate. Mm. But I think what is increasingly being recognised, what is positive from this, is just an awareness that there isn't an absolute identity between somebody who is biologically female and somebody who is choosing to identify as female as a matter of kind of gender. And at one level, it's been, I think, a problem that our culture sought to pretend that those two things are absolutely identical. What we're now discovering is in a whole variety of ways that isn't the case. Mm. There isn't a universal acceptance on the part of biological women that trans women should all be accepted as part of the female community. Mm. And then there are these very practical realities that are demonstrated. And in many ways, that confirms what we know biblically, which is that God has created men and women, a binary distinction between sexes, which has implications for every area of life. And the attempts to try to erase that and overcome that run into these kind of fundamental problems mm-hmm. that simply reflect the way that the world is and the way that it's being created.
Can I ask a question pastorally? So it's fine to talk about the rights and the wrongs and the law and the black and the white, but there are loads of shades of grey, aren't there? And there will be people in our churches, perhaps leaders listening to this have got people in their churches struggling with gender dysphoria, struggling with same-sex attraction. How do we move this to the pastoral level rather than the rights and the wrongs? Because I would suggest the last thing somebody struggling with those things in your church wants to hear is the pastor at the front just talking about the rights and wrongs when it doesn't feel like that to you. So what would you advise as pastors?
Well, we've talked about this before a little bit, I think. You have to keep thinking about people as individuals. Mm. And I think that's really important. So we are talking in generalities and we are smoothing distinctions because that's the only way you can talk about big issues. And of course, on the big stage, one of the great dangers is you use individual cases to prove your point and you use individual cases which tend to be at the extreme and you end up thereby often making bad laws. Mm. However, when you come and think pastorally and locally, we are shepherds of the flock that are in front of us, and that means the individuals. And so you do have to think about individuals. I think there are a number of things that we can do to be careful and kind and gracious without compromising on our fundamental convictions that don't cost us anything. So a good example, put a gender neutral toilet in your church. You know, that doesn't cost you anything. You're not in doing that, you're not saying I take this position or that position. And I think we have got to draw our battle lines, if that's the right phrase, carefully. So if someone comes in and says they want to be addressed as they rather than he or she, I think you've got to think very carefully, is that the battle I really want to fight? Mm. Is actually that going to advance the gospel and help people understand what the big issues are? And I think the answers to those questions are not always quite as obvious as people think they are, first of all. So, if you're building a new building and you put in a gender-neutral cubicle, we've got them here in the office. We didn't do that because of transgender people. We just did it to try and create more toilets, as it happens. But, those things cost nothing. Mm. And I don't think are a capitulation to the culture that we sometimes think they are. So I think to be clear in our own minds about exactly, what we can do to be kind and welcoming without compromising, I think that's an important discussion for church leaders to have. And then again, it's always be thinking about individuals.
I think we need to recognise there's different kinds of pastoral questions that are raised here. I think we need to have a real compassion for those who are struggling with these issues of gender identity and recognise that that is compounded by the message that's being heard by our society all the time. So there's no doubt there's massive pressure on young girls. There's a huge number of teenage girls who are now seeking to kind of transition, who are wondering whether or not they are transgender. Interestingly, there was an article in the paper this week about a girl who was encouraged to transition at the age of 18, who now regrets it and is detransitioning. And the message she received from the culture was transition because that's the answer to all of your problems. But I think we need to recognize this is a deep struggle for people. We don't need to see people, first of all, as kind of strident activists, but recognize underneath that there are some really deep and personal struggles. Right. I think we've become much better at recognizing the real struggle of same-sex attraction. Mm. And we need to do the same in recognizing the reality of the struggle of gender confusion, which our society creates. And then I think there are different stages at which people are at. So some of our pastoral care may be for people who are questioning their gender and wondering whether they should transition. And I think at that point, we do have to maintain a clear biblical line that says, actually, no, God has created you male and female. Yeah. We need to be pastorally helping people to accept the sex and the gender that God has created them to be. And that's why bans on conversion therapy could be so dangerous in terms of not enabling us to help those teenagers who are struggling with gender issues to, in a sense, resist the pressure to transition. And all the evidence is, I mean, it's often said, you know, if you don't transition, the suicide rates are higher. It's clear now the suicide rates for people struggling with sort of transgender issues are no different between those who've transitioned and those who haven't. It's not a solution to the deep personal problems, which we know are the result of living in a fallen world and sin. So I think how we care for those who are struggling with gender issues and are wondering about transitioning is one issue. There then may well be people presenting in church who have transitioned. Maybe they transitioned and they've subsequently become a Christian. And actually there we're dealing with a very different situation of somebody who's maybe engaged in hormone therapy, somebody who's been living as a particular gender for a long period of time. They might be in a relationship. They might be married and have children. They might have undergone surgery. Now, that's a very different situation where we've got to think about how does the gospel apply into the life of somebody who has done something that's unbiblical, but at one level isn't easily reversed and undone. And it's not massively different from how do we deal with people when we discover they've been divorced, but there were no biblical grounds for divorce. Sometimes we have to pastorally live with a mess that's been created. And actually there we have to have immense wisdom to know how do we manage caring for somebody who has done something that now in retrospect we hope biblically they understand wasn't right. But it's not the kind of situation that you can easily undo.
And still individuals, right, Phil? That's still thinking about people's individuals. I think one of the other interesting things to come out of this is just the response of Stonewall. So there was a conference, major conference planned by the government, and Stonewall have led a boycott of it in response to all the transgender and the U-turn on the U-turn, the no-turn, as you called it, and persuaded 100 other groups to boycott the conference. So the conference has come to an end. And fascinatingly, this morning, in fact, one of the founders of Stonewall, who's no longer involved with Stonewall, saying it's extraordinarily petulant of them and doesn't actually get you anywhere. It's kind of cancel culture on a massive scale. And I think there's a lesson in there for us as church leaders. You know, how do we respond when we don't get our way? How do we respond when we make all the arguments that we want to make about an issue, whatever it may be? You know, and we feel very strongly about some issues, don't we? Abortion and marriage and transgender thing. There's so many issues that we feel really strongly about and we think the Bible is clear about. How do we respond when we don't get our way? And there is always a temptation, I think, to petulance and to sort of throwing the toys out of the pram. And I just don't think that's the way Christianly to respond. We're going to lose any influence we do have. We've got to respond wisely, and we've got to do that, I think, with our eyes firmly fixed on the fact that we are in this broken world, and we know one day everything is going to be made new. So I think there's an underlying message in there for us as Christians and how we lead our churches, in how we as churches respond to seemingly losing fights along the way.
I think it would also be worth encouraging to keep praying for government and those who are working on this area of legislation as it comes forwards, and then Parliament as it scrutinises it. There are evangelical Christians working in government that are involved in this. It is an incredibly difficult balancing act they're having to engage in. I think we should just ask and pray that God would be at work there, that he would be particularly upholding them, that he'd be granting common grace wisdom, even to those who aren't believers, who are trying to work out how to draft this legislation in a way that outlaws what we would all regard as being unacceptable, but without restricting freedoms that we think are really, really important. And I think the debacle has shown the difficulty of that problem. Government needs immense wisdom to deal with that, and maybe pray that as they wrestle with these issues and recognize the complexity, they might be, in a sense, open to listening to the Christian view and to understanding why that is wise, good, and beneficial for society as a whole.
Yeah. We will see what happens when we have the Queen's speech on conversion therapy in, I think it's May time, isn't it, that will be brought forward. I want to move us on. There's been, we've spoken a lot about the war in Ukraine on the podcast over the last month or so. Huge human tragedy and suffering is continuing there. I wanted to pick up today on, there's been a bit of criticism this week of evangelicals. Basically, the criticism's been made. We're talking a lot about, as we've just done, sex and gender and all the moral issues that are surrounding that. The question was posed, why are we not talking more about the moral reality of what's happening in Ukraine and Putin's campaign against the Ukrainian people? Why are we not being as vocal about that? Is that a fair criticism? Have we not been strong enough in condemning what's happening in Ukraine?
Goodness. Well, I think that the answer probably is we haven't been. I think evangelical leaders are beginning to come around to see that. But it is also a developing situation. So I think we are learning new things every week, aren't we? And things are becoming clearer. I think especially this week, for example, there have been developments in Bucha and seeing that as the Russians have withdrawn from that, clearly left behind terrible devastation, not just of the kind of the infrastructure, which are the pictures we're used to seeing, but actually clearly crimes committed against people and whole groups of people, seeing, pictures of bodies in the street, hands tied, hearing about sexual assaults and just really horrific things. So I think the situation is dynamic and developing, and people are beginning to wise up really to what's going on.
I think that's right. I think, there needs to be an accumulation of evidence. I mean, actually, history does show that there are claims of war crimes that in the end are not substantiated. I think in this case, there is compelling evidence and increasing evidence of appalling brutality exercised by the Russians. I mean, there was condemnation of the Russians for, shelling cities in the invasion in the first place. So I don't think there's been no condemnation. But I think as the nature of what the Russians has done, at one level, there's maybe a cynical lack of surprise that that's what they've done. But there is a growing, compelling case of appalling abuses that have been conducted. And Christians haven't been totally silent. So, for example, I mean, I talked about Rowan Williams and his comments about transgenderism, which I think were totally inappropriate. He was, however, very vocal in his criticism of the Russian Orthodox Church for the way the Russian Orthodox Church has supported Putin, supported his action, basically declared that Ukraine has no rights to exist as a nation. And I think sort of that has been a very powerful voice speaking against the wickedness of what is being done. And I think as Christians, we do need to speak very clearly about the injustices. It's right that the world is demanding that action be taken and that those responsible be held to account. So there's talk about sort of war crimes. Yep. Russia has been thrown off the human rights group at the UN. As Christians, we want to support that. At the same time, I think we probably have a realistic view that recognizes that in a fallen world, justice isn't always done here. And at one level, we have an ultimate hope of justice that will be done. Who knows whether Putin will ever be sort of put on trial for war crimes and held to account. It seems difficult to see how that could be the case unless for some reason the Russian authorities were ever to want to hand him over. But we know that he will stand before the bar of God's judgment.
Absolutely.
And it's actually very striking how much of biblical praying is actually a prayer for God to do justice. Many of the Psalms are prayers for God to do justice and bring sort of appropriate vengeance on those who have behaved unjustly and wickedly. In many ways, the cry, "Your kingdom come," is a cry ultimately for Jesus to return and for justice to be done. Yeah. The parable of the persistent widow, we're to be those who are looking for justice. So there's a sense in which at Christians, we want to see as much justice done temporally as is possible. But we recognize in a fallen world that will never be perfect. And so we also look forward to and cry for the ultimate doing of justice.
And isn't it fascinating, actually, that if you pursue a liberal theology which downplays judgment, you lose that. You lose the ultimate knowledge that justice will be done, because if there's no judgment, then there's no accounting. And actually, you can see that your whole worldview falls apart at some level. Well, it's absolutely critical.
Universalism falls apart when you look at what's happening in Ukraine. How could you possibly say, oh, well, it's all going to be all right in the end and everybody will be welcomed into eternity? There would be no justice at all, would there?
And I think the other danger is that as human beings, we have a desire for justice, but that can easily become a sort of a vengeance, which is not just. Mm. And actually, the biblical kind of trusting judgment to God is actually also a defense against falling into that danger of being those who simply sort of respond with vengeance. And in war, what very often happens is one side commits atrocities and the other side responds with atrocities, that what looks like justice actually becomes a kind of a form of vengeance, and we need to avoid that as well. I do wonder, though, in relation to Putin, whether one of the things about Christians is there are some Christians who I think have had a more positive view of Putin, and actually their eyes are being gradually opened to the reality of who he is. So Putin stood against what was seen as the decadence of the West. He was against sort of homosexuality, gay pride, and all of those things. I think there are some Christians who have sadly looked at that and seen there's a kind of a strong leader defending the kind of Christian culture we want. And it's been more difficult for them to actually critique kind of Putin. But I hope that as the reality becomes more and more obvious, we'll recognize that here is somebody who is deeply kind of abusive of people, that veneer of supposed support of Christian civilization actually masks something very wicked underneath it. And it's a warning to us not to be taken in just by those superficial things. Mm. I think sometimes we can be taken in by a superficial commitment to certain moral positions that we think are really important, and we lose sight of the reality of what's happening there. And I think that for some of the Christian community, looking to leaders like Putin, they've been attracted to what seems to be this resistance to the march of progressivism and secularism. But yet the reality is he has always been an authoritarian, kind of manipulative, corrupt politician.
I don't know if we're allowed to promote other podcasts. Let's do it anyway.
Go on, I'll allow it.
Secular Adrian. Podcast, The Rest is History, which has some really good stuff on it. There are four episodes, we'll put the links in the bottom of the details of this podcast, about how really Russia went from communist Russia to what it is today, and via Yeltsin and Gorbachev and Yeltsin into Putin. Quite a sort of a high-level overview, but I found really insightful. I mean, obviously, we understand a meta-narrative that those guys don't understand in terms of the way that God is sovereign and the human heart is black and sinful. So we understand a slightly different meta-narrative, but humanly speaking, really good insight just into how have we got to where we've got today.
We'll put the links in the bottom. Another link we'll put in the bottom is to our website, where we've published something this week about Ukraine Connect, a great initiative from IFES and Langham and others who are basically matching Christian families with refugees coming from Ukraine. That is a great initiative. Do check out the website, have a look at that. We're really grateful for the work. I think UFM involved in that as well. Grateful to the Lord for them. So do check that out on the website as well, if you can support and help Ukrainian refugees. We'll bring this into land, gentlemen, the last couple of minutes. Let's just talk a little bit about what's been happening with the Chancellor this week.
So no FIEC members of staff, as far as I'm aware, have non-dom status. Just to clarify the situation.
We think that's where we are. We've done a quick conversation about that this morning. I think that the point is here, whatever's happening, it doesn't look good, does it? I want to be very clear. I think it's absolutely right that Akshata Murthy has not done anything wrong, but
it's right that she hasn't done anything wrong.
Yeah,
you mean she had? You're just saying she hasn't broken any.
She's not broken any laws whatsoever. She's done nothing wrong, but the way it looks is the problem here. So I think the question is, how are we seen to be doing the right thing rather than just doing the right thing? Because that's the problem here, isn't it? She's done the right thing, however, it's not being seen to be the right thing. It's not as clear as it could be. How do we respond to that?
Well, you can, as Christian leaders and as Christians generally, we can be obsessed in what people think of us. Mm. And ultimately that becomes a sin. If our key driver is what does Bob, what does Sue think of me, rather than what does God think of me, there is clearly something fundamentally wrong there with your direction of travel. Mm. So I think we need to call that out. However, it is also a good Christian principle that we should think of the interests of others before ourselves. So we should be thinking about the effect that our actions have on others. And I think that includes how they're perceived by others. So as always, there's no clear answer. Just do this, don't do that. The Christian life is a lot more complex than that, which is why we're so grateful for the gift of the Spirit who gives us wisdom to help us to know how to navigate some of these areas. We kind of live in the grey hinterland rather than at the black and white ends of the ethical spectrum on lots of these things. So I think there is clearly a sin at one end, which is just to be thinking all the time, how is this going to come across? How am I going to be perceived? It's kind of a people pleasing on speed, really, at one end. But I think there is another sin that leaders can fall into as well. That is a leadership sin. There's another sin that leaders can fall into, which is to say, as long as I'm clear in my conscience that I've done the right thing, I don't really care what other people think. My conscience is clear before the Lord, and that's sufficient. I don't think that's leading the flock. That's not shepherding the flock. It's certainly not thinking of the interests of the flock and how things are perceived. I trained as a chartered accountant, which I think, based on one of our previous conversations, makes me one of the most boring people in the world.
Yeah.
But actually, one of the things that we were always told from the outset was that we were to be objective and to be seen to be objective. We always ought to be holding those two things together. And I think there's a sense in which, in Christian leadership, we do need to be thinking about our decisions and our lifestyle, for example, and things like that, and how they appear to others. And I just think that's good Christian living.
I mean, I think it seems to me one of the questions here is, what do we want from our leaders and when do we trust our leaders? So I think the reason why this has become such a story is that we're obviously in a period of kind of a cost of living crisis. Taxes have just been increased. So ordinary people earning very small amounts of kind of money in big terms are facing an increase in tax, massive increases in their electricity and gas bills. Benefits are not going up in line with inflation. So most people are facing what is going to be a very significant cut in their standard of living at this particular time. And Rishi Sunak, as Chancellor, has responsibility for those decisions. And I think what's really kind of being pointed out is that he and his family are immensely wealthy and that this won't have any real impact on them.
For them, Mrs. S is paying more to maintain her non-domiciled status than the average salary in the UK.
Absolutely.
So does that mean that he can't be Chancellor? Can he have nothing to do with ordinary people?
I think that's the challenge, because at one level, there's no doubt that Rishi Sunak and his wife are incredibly competent and capable. They've had a successful career. They've made money from that. At one level, you might want to say, in leadership, you want people who have that degree of competence to be able to make the decisions in the interests of others. So, you know, there have always been politicians and others who are wealthy, whether independently or from inheritance.
George Osborne was pretty wealthy. I'm not in the absolutely. Same, not in the same degree, but he was pretty wealthy, wasn't he?
So, you know, competence is perhaps sort of massively significant. But I do think when we're in kind of a time of trouble and difficulty, we do actually want the sense that our leaders understand us and aware of what our lives are like and are not simply taking decisions that will have no impact on them, but will have an impact on us. So we want to be led by people who we feel understand and have a grasp of the reality of what life is like. And I guess for us that points us to the Lord Jesus as the one who, in a sense, is wealthier than anyone else. He is the Lord of glory. And yet, in his leadership, he was willing to give all of that up and become a servant and come and live a human life and experience what it was to be us. And I think that means that in the Lord Jesus, you have that competence, that combination of the ultimate competence and resources, but also an empathy that comes from having lived the life that we've lived and known what that is like. And that enables us to relate to him, I think, in a way that we know that he sympathizes with the reality of the human condition. Now, I don't know Rishi Sunak, and I think only if you knew him personally would you be able to make the judgment, does he really empathize with those who are facing these struggles? You can't know that just from the publication of whether or not his wife has got non-dom status. But for the Lord Jesus, we do have the one who has entered into our lives. Now, I think that actually has important implications for church leadership, because actually the people in our congregation need to know that we connect with them, that we sympathize with them, that we understand them. It will be more difficult to lead a congregation of God's people if you are very different from them in terms of lifestyle, wealth, expectations, and are leading from a distance. And, you know, historically, there were vicars and clergy who were massively wealthy leading their churches. And you inevitably have a trust deficit in leadership where that is the case. We need to be those who connect with the people because we are part of the people.
Yeah. That's great. We need to bring it into land, gentlemen. Thank you for talking this afternoon. Just before we go, don't forget to book for the Leaders Conference. Where were we on Monday, Adrian?
We went to Blackpool on Monday. We took a photo, you and I, underneath Eric Morecambe and Ernie Wise. Yep. What a great moment that was.
Absolutely. The sea was looking angry.
And yes, but the venue was looking great.
It was, wasn't
really
it?
Really good. I'm so excited.
I think it's July the 1st, you can book for £195. So the early booking deadline is there. So do go and book if you've not done so far. This has been Independence, the FIC podcast. Do subscribe through the usual channels, and we look forward to being with you again
soon.
Thanks, Phil.